Okay, greetings and welcome to everybody. Thank you for joining us. We have a very good crowd today, so that's encouraging. I'm pleased to introduce Professor Ravi Gupta from the Utah State University and Dr. Kenneth Velpy. Both of these are early doctoral students at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies and are senior fellows of the center, and are also involved in our Bhagavat Purana project, which makes them the perfect people to speak to us today. And I'll let them introduce themselves a little bit once they get started. But just to give the structure, we're looking at about 30 to 40 minutes of talking. And following that, we'll fill out the hour with some questions and answers. Now, because we have so many people, it's really not going to work if everybody just calls out questions. So if you could put your questions into the chat, that would be really helpful. And then I'll share those questions with our speakers. We'll get to as many as we can, but I do have a feeling that we're probably not going to get to all of them, and I'll apologize for that in advance. But without any further ado, I will pass you over to Ken and Ravi. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Lal, and thank you all for joining. I must say, I had no idea that there would be so many of you, so many of us, and this is encouraging. So I think our subject is the Bhagavata Purana, and I think more specifically we want to speak something about the course which we're going to be presenting. Ravi, do you want to agree or disagree with that?
No, I'm just delighted to be here, same as you, Kenneth, and looking forward to this conversation, more so than a lecture. I think you'll get more of the content in the course if you choose to sign up. But at this point, I think we're looking forward to a conversation between the two of us and then with all of you. So.
Yes. As far as introductions go, what can I say? I'm a research fellow of the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, which I've been since receiving my degree at Oxford. That was more than 2 decades ago, actually. Time is actually, yes, it's come to think of it, it's exactly two decades ago. And I think it may be interesting to some of you that Ravi and I were schoolmates from the beginning of our time in Oxford. But there was one significant difference between us. We started, we came at the same time. That was, what, 1999, wasn't it?
Yes.
But there was one difference. Ravi was 17 years old, and I was, what was I, 47, something like that. Yeah. But I think we, how to say, the chemistry was good for studying as we proceeded with our courses. We were running very much parallel and encouraging each other. And since then, we've been co-directing the Bhagavata Purana Research Project of the OCHS. And within that, we may speak something more about that later. That's about it about me. Although I'm a research fellow of this center, I'm not so much physically in Oxford since a few years now. I do a fair amount of traveling, teaching, sort of an itinerant teacher of bhakti yoga, if you like. So that's about it about me, I think, for now. So over to you, Ravi.
Thank you. Thank you. So happy to see many friends here, and as well as so many new faces. I hope we'll get a chance to get to know you more in time. So I just a little bit about myself. I too am a research fellow at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. But most of my time is spent here in the United States, in Utah in particular, where I'm a professor of religious studies at Utah State University. Mostly I teach courses in world religions, in Hinduism, as well as courses on theory and method in religious studies for our majors. But actually, I'm not doing all that much teaching at the moment. For the past 3 years, I've been working largely in an administrative role as department head for history, religious studies, and classics, three faculties, around 30 professors or so, and that takes the bulk of my time. And so I'm looking forward to this opportunity to teach a subject that I love very much. And both of us, in fact, have spent many decades studying the Bhagavata Purana. And we've published two books on the topic that have been published by Columbia University Press. And it's been a few years since those have come out. One is a book of translations that is an abridged translation of the Bhagavata, and quite abridged because it's only about 10% of the text. And then another collection of articles by scholars on the various aspects of the Bhagavata's impact on Indian history and global history and culture. So that's my area of research and what I love doing. So I'm looking forward to this course as an opportunity to take some time away from administration and back into the world of the Bhagavata. So thank you all for being here.
One thing you're expressing eagerness to teach a course on something which is close to us. And just today I was listening to a conversation online between two professors, young professors, who were kind of commiserating with each other about how it's practically never possible for them to teach what they're actually interested in, what their specialties. You know, professors always have their specialties, so they hardly get. But they were saying with programs, actually this was in relation to something similar to what we're doing here, they were saying how nice it is that we can discuss things that are close to us, of interest. Getting into our subject, because you just also broke in, so to say, into the phrase, the world of the Bhagavata. So maybe you could say something about the structure of our course and that sort of two-aspect element of the course.
Yes. So a little overview of the course. The way we decided, because this is a team-taught course, which is, I think, still rather unusual. Most academic courses, either at the OCHLs or elsewhere, tend to be taught by a single person and designed by a single person. But as Kenneth has mentioned, we've done this as a team for many years now, starting with our graduate work. We've written books together, we've taught together at the same university, and we do research together even now. And so this is one of the things I think that is special about this course, and I hope you will enjoy, is the fact that we teach through conversation. And that means instead of giving a lecture where one of us will stand up and speak for 45 minutes and then he'll stand up and speak, instead of doing that, you'll find that all of our videos for this online course are professionally recorded at a studio here at Utah State. And they consist of conversations between the two of us with each about, what is it, 8 or 9 conversations, I forget.
8, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. 8 conversations, with half of them as with me as the interviewer, and the other half as with Kenneth as the interviewer, even though both of us are contributing in each conversation. That way we keep it going. So that's the format for today as well, for the few minutes that we have together. Is this time around, Kenneth is the one asking the questions, although I hope he'll participate in answering them as well. So to get to your question, the structure of the course and the books. So we have 8 classes and 8 modules, and these modules, they switch between 2 themes. So these 2 themes come from our book, the Bhagavata Purana, Sacred Text and Living Tradition, which is a book that is part of the reading for this course. It's the entire book is actually included within the cost of the course. And there's two themes in this book. One is the world of the Bhagavata Purana and the Bhagavata in the world. So the first theme is basically our attempt to unpack what the Bhagavata is doing and saying. It's such an incredibly varied text with not only a depth of theology and philosophy, but also exquisite poetry. So it's a work of wonderful literature. And that's something unusual about most Puranas and most Sanskrit works, is that they don't typically combine great skill in both of these areas. So the world of the Bhagavata is an attempt to unpack that world, to introduce you to what's happening in the text itself. And then the Bhagavata in the world is an attempt to then show how this text has impacted the world in which we live through dance, music, drama, so various kinds of performance, or ritual, philosophy, theology, storytelling. So in this way, the course actually alternates between these two themes. We talk about a theme related to what's happening in the text, then we talk about its impact in the broader world, then the text, then the impact. In this way, we hope to keep things interesting so that you're switching between these two modes of study of the text.
It strikes me that as we speak, this is kind of an enacting the Bhagavata in the world, because here we are, we're online and we're speaking with all of you. And so one of the themes, we might say, behind especially the Bhagavata in the world aspect, excuse me, my voice is a bit grumbly this evening, the sense that the Bhagavata is a living tradition. In fact, this is part of the half of the subtitle of our book, Sacred Text and Living Tradition, that there's a sense that the Puranas in particular, this genre of literature, Sanskrit literature in India, in particular, the Bhagavata Purana has, one might want to say, a kind of life of its own. I hate to use the word popular religion. It's much, it's more than popular. It's popular, it's classical, it's everything in between, I think one could say. So in this respect, it seems to me also we could talk about the dialogical nature of the Bhagavad. So maybe, Ravi, you want to say something about that and how that... So we have the dialogue of the two of us talking about the Bhagavata Purana, also known as Srimad Bhagavata Purana, or in North Europe, North India, Bhagavat Purana, or Srimad Bhagavatam in... I think especially in South India, it would be called Bhagavatam. But something about, can you say something about the dialogical character of the Bhagavatam?
Yes, definitely. I think one of the things that is important about Sanskrit literature, really from the time of the Upanishads, to the present day, is that, but especially in the Puranas, is that so much of these texts are driven through conversation, through dialogue, often between students and teachers, sages and kings, but also between peers, that is, people who are... similarly, you know, knowledgeable and are conversing about a topic they are interested in, and occasionally with debates as well. So conversations drive so much of Sanskrit literature. And nowhere is this more true than the Puranas. As a genre of literature, the Puranas have many things in common, but one of these things is their mode of teaching, which is that of dialogue. And these dialogues... there's a few things that happens when a text is driven by dialogue. One is that it's always, shall we say, in modern language, student-driven. It's student-driven teaching. It's the student, the listener, who is eager to learn more and drives the movement of the conversation by saying, "Ah, that was very interesting. Along the way, you mentioned this. I want to know more about it." And then they say, okay, and then they move back and fill in more details. So it's student-driven. It's also another characteristic, I think, of the dialogical format is that it's usually not chronological. Conversations, if you think of conversations, whether they be academic or casual, personal conversations, they rarely follow a predefined structure. And if they do, then they're usually not a lot of fun. Conversations tend to move in all kinds of directions based on what people think of and how they remember and what they're interested in. And so the Puranas have this really convoluted is too negative a term, something more positive than that. It's a very dynamic sort of structure where you never quite know where you're at any given time, unless you really attempt to do a very careful reading and unraveling of the threads, like a ball of yarn. It all gets all raveled, and then you have to unravel it if you're interested in chronology. But most of the time, they're not. The text itself is not interested in chronology. They're interested in the narrative, even as it's winding. And so that dialogical structure lends a sort of a timeless quality to the Puranas, because they're talking about things that for which we don't really care when they happened or in what order they happened, because they're always happening. As Kenneth had said earlier, in some sense, we're reenacting the Bhagavata here, even now, as we speak of it, this dialogical structure of the text, the two of us and all of you. And so they develop this timeless quality and then and pull the reader into their world that's set apart. So that's one of the things, in fact, we talk about in the course is the time, the idea of time in the text. So these dialogues become nested. They become, two people are talking and they speak about a conversation between another two people in order to provide a story or to tell an account, who then, as they're speaking, refer to a conversation with yet another pair, and so on. And I think it can get nested quite a bit. What's the maximum that we've counted, Ken? Do you remember?
At least five. In seventh skanda, there's a section where there's five levels going on at the same time. Yeah. you mentioned time being sort of secondary. I don't want to disagree, but I also want to say there is a structural element, a sequentiality. It's not that it's simply helter-skelter. I think one could say, for one thing, because I often see the Bhagavad as a kind of sequel to the Mahabharata. In a sense, also as a commentary to the Mahabharata, a commentary which wants to emphasize the theme and the sense, the meaning of bhakti. I was just reading Professor Greg Bailey in Australia, a scholar of the Puranas. He's done considerable publishing on various Puranas, and he speaks of how the Puranas have this, I think he calls it the semantics of bhakti, is what sort of governs the entire genre of the Puranas in general. Mm. And maybe you could say something about that and how that comes out in particular in the Bhagavad.
The semantics of bhakti?
Yes.
But what do you mean by the semantics of bhakti?
Semantics is that aspect of language which is about meaning. So how is the Bhagavata bringing forth, you know, bhakti as the primary sense?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say you're always welcome to disagree with me anytime. This is the benefit of being in dialogue. But you're right. You're right. The Bhagavata is not helter skelter. It's actually a actually, it's better organized than most Puranas are in terms of its structural integrity. And this is something that scholars of the text have noted in the way that it hangs together very tightly, in the way that a text would if it were written from start to finish by a single author or a group of authors, rather than developing through an accretion of themes and ideas and content over time, right? So the text seems to be aware of its own structure at times. And that structure can be organized based on genealogy. It can be organized based on time cycles. That's another big element of how it's structured. And also in terms of different avatars of Vishnu. So just to affirm, I think, what you said, and an important balance to what I had said earlier, that yes, there's structure to the text, and hopefully we can clarify that structure in the process of the course. But now to your question of semantics of bhakti. So the Bhagavata is, it really does privilege bhakti as this one element that takes precedence over all the other factors that influence human life. So, for example, the big kind of, I would say, the big the item that stands in tension often to bhakti is dharma, the notion that this world has order to it, and that order is social, and it's a natural order as well, and therefore everyone has their place and has their social roles to do and their duties connected with that dharma. So the Bhagavata does not give up on dharma. In fact, it emphasizes it in many ways. And yet, it also, even as it uplifts dharma, it undermines it at the same time, or perhaps supersedes it through its very expansive understanding of bhakti. Bhakti as that which takes precedence over the organizing structures of dharma. So the Bhagavata is interesting because of the ways in which it takes it turns upside down. It reverses the structures of dharma that are quite widely accepted in Sanskrit literature. So often Brahmins find themselves being taught by those of lower caste. Women teach their husbands. Animals turn out to be brighter and more devoted than human beings. Children give instruction to their parents. And all the hierarchies that structure our dharmic world, and indeed that put dharmas in conflict with each other, the competing obligations that we face from various sources. This is the story, for those who are familiar, of the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata, as Kenneth mentioned, the Bhagavata is in some ways a sequel to the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata is all about dharmas that conflict with each other and therefore cannot be fulfilled perfectly by anyone, even by dharmic heroes like the Pandavas. No one can get it all right. And the Bhagavata in many ways provides a solution to that by saying, well, you cannot get it right in this world, not entirely. It's worth trying, because otherwise the world can't go on. But there's something that supersedes it. It can't be perfected, but it can be transcended through the power of bhakti, the radical power of bhakti, its ability to destabilize dharma and to supersede it.
Mm. This reminds me of the very second stanza of the text, which speaks quite strongly. Dharma projita kaitavotra paramonir matsaranam satam. That what it calls Kaitava Dharma, Kaitava from Kitava, it can mean something like cheating. So it's saying, this Bhagavad, this text, what you're going to be reading or hearing, we're going to reject any sort of dharma which is not the real thing. So the Bhagavad is making a claim to not just turn dharma upside down, but to say what is authentic dharma. Because it's been said that the Mahabharata raises the question, what is dharma? And it gives, you know, hundreds, thousands of answers, and never really settles on any one of them. So the Bhagavad comes and says, well, first of all, let's distinguish between what's authentic and what's inauthentic. But someone may say, this may be a kind of purva paksha, a argument against the Bhagavad, that, oh, this is a Purana, and we all know that the Puranas are very sectarian. So that means the Bhagavad Purana is also sectarian, yes?
Yes, I mean, on some level, certainly, yes. It's a Vaishnava text, and it's very much grounded in devotion to Vishnu, but particularly to Krishna. So on one level, yes. On the other hand, I think this is, and this is one of the things we actually begin with in our course, is that the Bhagavata is a work of classical literature. And like any good classic, it really resists definitive interpretation. It really breaks out from whatever sectarian categories one might want to put the text into. And I think this is visible, particularly in the Puranas commentarial tradition. The vast majority of commentaries are, of course, Vaishnava, but not from any particular Vaishnava tradition or lineage, but from a wide variety. And then also there are commentaries on the text from Shaivas and from non-dualist Vedantins, which have traditionally been the main Purva Paksha for Vaishnavas. There's been commentaries from, just about every perspective one could think of, with everyone wanting to lay a claim to the text. And I think what's interesting is that the Bhagavata provides them with plenty of...
support. For their positions. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's an adequate playground for everyone of all kinds of backgrounds and interests. Mm. One scholar who has studied the Bhagavata, Anand Venkat Krishnan, has done an excellent job of recognizing and highlighting the Shaiva themes within this text dedicated to Shiva, which are quite significant. He's not a minor a deity to be put down by a Vaishnava text, not at all. In fact, he emerges quite significantly to the point where I think Venkat Krishnan notes a possible Shaiva influence in the composition of the text itself.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of commentary, I wanted to also point out that it's not just these sort of very ancient commentaries that exist, although of the early, the Sanskrit commentaries, there is a count of some 880 commentaries, as I understand. I haven't seen all of them, but some 25 of them, I think, are in the main publication of commentaries. But also what I wanted to say is I've been working on a bibliography of writings about the Bhagavat in just English language over the last few weeks. Well, I started some months ago. And it's quite a list of books and doctoral dissertations and published articles and translations, and you could say transcreations. I think I'm up to around 10 pages, single-spaced, just of these items and just in English. So the commentarial tradition in that sense, you could say, is still going on.
Indeed.
So maybe we should say something about you spoke about the nested. No, let's talk about the course itself and how it works. I have to first of all admit this is the first time that I'm involved in a course with the OCHS. I know that we're going to be supported by Lal Krishna with the sort of technical side of the course. Beyond that, we already heard there are 8 lectures, but they're not lectures, they're conversations between the two of us. And there are also, for those who wish to sort of take the next step, there is the possibility to write essay for which we've given some possible themes, questions that can be addressed for the purpose of making the course for credit, as I understand. Do I have this right, Lal? Are you there? Yes.
95%.
95%.
The one thing is that the courses aren't accredited.
Oh. They're not at all? Accredited with... Okay, but they're internally accredited, shall we say?
Yeah, we give a completion certificate, yes.
Right, okay. That's what I meant. Good. Yeah, so let's see. I see some questions and comments coming up on the chat. Should we address these?
Yes, if you like, you can deal with them directly, or I can throw them at you, whichever works better for you.
How about you throw something at us?
Okay. Here's one. It's a question comment. It's from David. It says, it seems like bhakti is another way of dealing with the problems of dharmas coming into conflict in the Mahabharata.
Mm-hmm. This was actually... I saw this comment pop up as I was giving my answer to the semantics of bhakti question. So that's thank you, David, because that's precisely what led me into talking about the Mahabharatas. either you anticipated or you prompted is probably the better term. You prompted what I said there on the Mahabharata's relationship to the Bhagavata Purana and bhakti as a way of superseding dharma. But Kenneth, if there's anything else you would like to add, please feel free.
I think we say something more about that in our discussions. But what I see is, especially in the first book, as a kind of sequel to the Mahabharata, I always like to think of like a stage performance, and when the performance is ended, then all the actors come out on stage, and now they're in their own persona. They've set aside their acting persona. And they relate to each other, you know, in friendly ways. They bow to the audience. They interact as what we might call normal, everyday people. And in some sense, that is what we see in especially the first book of the Bhagavata, the first skanda. Some of the important figures of the Mahabharata, the Pandavas, of course, and Draupadi, and Bhishma, and Krishna, especially, they come out as who they really are, so to say, or what the Bhagavata wants to say is their actual character, that they are in this bhakti atmosphere, so to say, which is about relationality between Bhagavan, the Supreme Person, and his devotee. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Great. And a related question from Monica. I'm not sure if there's an overlap here, but she's asking if the Bhagavad Purana sees Dharma as a way of sustaining universal well-being.
Most certainly. The Bhagavata does not give up on dharma. It overlays it with bhakti or infuses it with bhakti, but it does not give up on dharma's role as that which supports the world and human beings.
It's doing that at the same time asking the question and addressing the question. So what is being sustained? The word dharma has the sense of sustaining, holding. What is it that's being sustained? Well, the cosmos, this Brahmanda. Yes, and what is this Brahmanda? What is the purpose of this Brahmanda? The purpose being to be spiritually elevated. So then, if that's the case, then what are the real what are the authentic dynamics of dharma? And you could say the core of dharma in this understanding is bhakti. I think this is one way of putting it.
Yeah, I like that very much, because if you raise the question, dharma is what sustains universal well-being, then the Bhagavata says, well, how does that, as you just said, how does that sustaining happen? And finds Bhagavan to be at the foundation of that sustenance. Therefore, taking dharma and, yeah, placing bhakti at its heart. I like what you said. That makes a lot of sense.
And what's also interesting is that it relates this to experience. So, savai pungsang paro dharma yato bhaktir adhokshajaya haituki apratihata yayatma suprasidati. Suprasidati means complete illumination, felicity, satisfaction. So it's saying that you can measure this thing that's called dharma, this elusive principle, dharma, in terms of the activity, the engagement in bhakti, in devotion. And what's the measure of that success is there will be an experience of total self-satisfaction.
Well, I see questions coming
in. They're rolling in like anything. There's a few on commentaries and commentarial traditions. Maybe if you could have a look at those. Uh-huh. But I think there's also one that really follows on, I guess, from the Dharma discussion. Elliot is asking about moksha in the Bhagavad Purana.
Anything in particular about moksha? Or
is it discussed?
You want to go, Kenneth, first?
Yes, it's discussed.
Right.
But it's again, it's in the context of bhakti. So moksha you'll find in all classical Sanskrit Indian literature. It's kind of always the go-to principle. What is this text about? Oh, it's about moksha. I think even the Kama Sutra claims that it's about moksha, right? So there's also the term Kaivalya in the Bhagavata, which we find in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, Patanjali Yoga Shastra. But it's again, the inflection is always in terms of that which is understood to be actually motivating us, the need for relationality, which is interesting because Kaivalya is normally understood to be about isolation, about sort of absolute aloneness, but the Bhagavata gives a different spin on it.
Wonderful. Instead of me saying more on that topic, in the interest of time, perhaps I could say something about the commentaries question. There were a bundle of them that I've been looking through. I can try to bundle them together. Is that okay, Lal?
Yep, perfect.
Okay, so someone asked in general to say more about commentaries. The course, of course, provides more detail. Let me, I wanted to say something about this because I've been thinking a lot about it recently. I'll be giving a lecture at Princeton next week on the topic of Bhagavata commentaries, and the title is Commentators at Play: The Many Roles of Sanskrit Commentaries or of Bhagavata Commentaries. And I go through and talk about the various roles that commentaries play with a text like the Bhagavata, which, as Kenneth already said, has an unusually large profusion of commentaries from various perspectives. So I talk about the commentary or the commentator seeing the text as a fertile ground for theological insight. So I use the term kshetra or ground as kind of the theme. It's a fertile ground to develop theological ideas and to draw out the world of the text. It's also a construction ground where the commentator will build a theological edifice to promote or to develop their ideas. It's a community ground, or a fair ground, if you will, where every commentary is written for a community. It's written within a community. And if that commentary is successful, it will create a community around it. Mm. And then commentary is also a battleground, or a yuddha kshetra, a place where commentators will fight it out with each other to defend the edifice that they've created. So kshetra, punya kshetra, dharma kshetra as a community ground, yuddha kshetra as a battleground, and a lila kshetra, a place of play. Commentators have a great time writing their commentaries. They're showing off their skills. They're connecting with each other in the process. They're bringing out new meanings that are interesting and exciting. So it's a lila kshetra, a place of play. And for the Bhagavata itself, then we might conclude by saying it's the ground of being, the place where commentators not only want to go for battle and then come home, or go to play as in a playground and then come home, but it's the place they abide. It's the place they want to be, to live in. And they're always conscious of what they're doing. They praise the act of reading itself or hearing itself because it's a ground of being, which I call Krishna Kshetra, because that's the place where, for the Bhagavata, Krishna abides, right? So in this way, we might think of commentaries as doing many, many different things. And they're much more interesting worlds, I think, than we often give them credit for. Most people think of commentary as something that's pedantic and boring and plodding. But in reality, commentaries are a lot of fun and very interesting. Yeah.
That's going to be a colorful presentation that you give at Princeton.
I'm looking forward to it. Okay, Lal, what's next?
Okay, I was busy typing as you were talking about your publications and commentaries. Did you cover the commentary questions?
Do you just think? Now you did, yes.
Them all. Okay, yeah. Great. Okay, well, we still have a few spaces. A few people have asked different things about how the course runs, and I really don't want to get into that now. But if you do sign up, you'll get a link to our Zoom sessions that we run during the term. And just to clarify, these are on a number of sessions. They're not specifically to do with this course, but they're to do with they're tutors from different courses talking about whatever it is that they're researching and studying at the moment. So they're very interesting. But amongst that, and the point I'm getting to, is that there's also a short video that explains how the whole thing works. And if you haven't done one of the courses before, it can be a little daunting up front. It's not always 100% clear. But once you get started, it's fairly self-explanatory how it all works. In the meantime, Shamita, Can you talk a little bit about dance in the text, maybe the Tandava dance of Krishna, and how it compares with the dance of Shiva, and how it relates to dance in Natya Shastra, etc.?
Ooh, wow.
Okay. I know you both love this topic. You're great dancers.
We need to invoke our dance specialist. Her name is slipping my mind just now. Zubko, Catherine Zubko, wrote one of the articles, one of the chapters in our book, and she discusses very interesting angle of how dance is a kind of yoga, a kind of bhakti yoga, so to speak. You use the word Tandava in connection with Krishna, and I must admit, I haven't ever heard that term in connection with Krishna. We hear it in connection with Shiva as a sort of dance of cosmic destruction in preparation for recreation. The dance for which Krishna is he's most celebrated is the Rasa dance, which is described in 5 chapters in the 10th book, and sometimes called the Rasa Panchadhyaya, the 5 chapters of the Rasa dance, which is a kind of drama. And some of the later writers have gone into some detail about just what that dancing of Krishna would be like. The Bhagavad itself is, because of the nature of the Bhagavad, it's in many respects summarizing and condensing. And so there's not a whole lot of detail about just how it is that Krishna dances. Another dance that Krishna performs is on the multi-headed serpent Kaliya, as a young boy, he is dancing on the heads of this multi-headed serpent, and again the later commentators elaborate on that dancing as indeed dancing to different rhythms and so on. What else can we say about Krishna's dancing off the top of our head?
One thing I'll just add to that excellent answer is that also not only Catherine Zubko's article, this is the book, by the way, that we keep referring to, called the Bhagavata Purana, Sacred Texts and Living Tradition. And this is the book that you'll get an electronic copy of when you register for the course. This is the other book, which is readings, Bhagavata Purana selected readings, and we give you excerpts as PDFs as part of the course reader. So it's not, you don't get the whole book, but you get sections that are relevant to the modules. But one other article that is relevant to this is Guy Beck's article on the music of the Bhagavata, because in the context of the Rasa dance, of course, music is the thread that keeps it going. And one of the things he mentions is that there are technical terms in the Bhagavata for different musical styles and instruments and even dance steps that are typically not recognizable to most translators unless they are trained in classical Indian musics and recognize the technical terminology. This is one of the things that makes the Bhagavata quite difficult as a text to translate, is that it contains a very vast vocabulary, a vocabulary that includes some Sanskrit terms that are either not found elsewhere or used in this particular way exclusively within the Bhagavata Purana, creating a situation where the dictionary is not very useful because it's just a very distinctive usage of terms. And some of the places where you find this is in technical terms. So I remember not in the music section, but in verses describing the beauty of Vaikuntha, which is Vishnu's heavenly abode, there's long lists of plants, flowers, and trees. And it was quite an expedition. Kenneth, you might remember this, trying to figure out what these plant names referred to. If you look it up in an older dictionary, it says that it means one thing. You look it up in a more recent dictionary, and it says it's a different plant. Mm. And so we asked around, consulted, and did the best we could. But I think it would really take a collaboration with a botanist to exactly figure out a historical botanist.
Or else it will say, it is a plant which appears in the Bhagavata Purana.
Yes. Yes. Dictionaries often do that sort of thing. You're looking up a particular word and you'll look it up in the dictionary, and the dictionary will say, this is what the word means, and its only instance is the verse that you're trying to translate, creating a very circular experience.
Right. I think we have time for one more question, which I think is very relevant in the study of texts. And that is, Noah is asking that he's heard that the 10th canto is confidential and sacred, therefore not to be read unless one is very advanced. Mm. What do you think about this, particularly in relation to the studies that we're doing here?
Very good question. Here I can't resist to tell what the very eminent professor Keith Ward quipped after he had received a gift of the Bhagavad in English translation. He came to our center, the OCHS, one day some years ago, and he said, you know, I was reading in the first book, and the commentary said that one should read all of the first 9 books before going to the 10th. One should not jump to the 10th. So I couldn't resist. I jumped straight to the 10th. So, yeah, this brings up a big question of adhikar, or qualification. And I would just say, Ravi, you can correct me. The way we're doing this course, it is an introduction. And as such, we're sort of all taking the position of beginners. And although we discuss also some aspects of the 10th book, it would not be in such a way as to be misconstrued. We also talk about the controversy that arose regarding the 10th book, and in particular the Rasa-lila description, and how in the 19th century this sort of kept the Victorians awake at night. But I think in this course that we're doing, there's, how to say, nothing to worry about.
We're actually in the course, we're not proceeding from one canto or one book to another at all. We're looking at themes overall that spread across the entire text. A systematic study from book 1 through book 12 would be far beyond the scope of what one can do in 8 modules. It's a large text. So I think it's important to recognize that if you're looking for a systematic, you know, verse 1 through verse 18,000 study, this is not the course for that. Rather, we're trying to gather together themes that span the entire work, the entire text. And those themes are outlined on the website, the OCHS online course website. So you can see them there.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you for taking the time for joining us this evening. And thank you all for also joining us. I'm afraid the hour has run out, but if you have any questions about the course, the OCHS in general, or if you'd like to pass on your questions to Ken and Ravi, just drop me a line. I put my email address in the chat. It's lal@ochs.org.uk. I think we can call that a day. Thank you very much. There will be a recording. So if you're on our mailing list, I'll be sending out the link in the next day or so, so you can catch up on any bits you missed. But thank you. Thank you very much, Ben and Ravi, and thank you all again.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
So nice to see you.
Thank you.